Welcome to the Institutional History Society's Valentine Special, Vinegar, Vitriol and Vehemence, the Violent Vanity of Victorian Valentines. Your hosts for today are Daniel Shepherd and Gemma Minter.
Our loved ones may be nailed in a coffin, but their epitaph is nailed on our hearts. Vincent Oke Nwachukwu. For time immemorial, love, crime, and imprisonment have been as linked as the ankle chains on a shuffling prisoner. One of the very first stories attributed to St. Valentine was that of his love for his jailer's daughter. He had supposedly cured her of blindness, fallen in love with her, and had sent her a note, closing with the oft-repeated nom de guerre, "From your Valentine." The oldest recorded Valentine was written in 1415 by another prisoner, this time Charles, the 21-year-old Duke of Orléans, to his beloved wife Bonne. Charles had been imprisoned in the Tower following his part in the Battle of Agincourt, and wrote to her, saying, "My gentle Valentine, since for me you were born too soon, and I for you was born too late, God forgives him who has estranged me from you for the whole year. I am already sick of love, my very gentle Valentine." Bonne's date of death isn't precisely known, but what is known is that she was fated never to lay eyes on her spouse again. Charles was released between 5 and 10 years after her death, his very gentle Valentine gone long before him.
The birth of the Valentine's Day card. You may be wondering how we cope before the advent of Moonpig, Vistaprint and Clinton's cards. Indeed, how were our ancestors able to express their undying devotion, their unfaltering ardour, without the mass-printed soulless platitudes on offer these days, for our special-ish loved ones? Did they paint words of love on the sides of sheep? Perhaps they scythed love letters in the meadows. Perhaps they even spoke. The sending of notes and flowers to loved and wronged ones has existed since at least the 1700s. These homemade missives would be chock-a-block with effusive words, declarations and allusions. But alas, with no actual chocolate blocks. That wasn't until 1868 with Cadbury's heart-shaped fancy boxes. By 1797, you could even buy pre-written verse to copy out in your very own handwriting and send your prized verse to the apple of your eye. The arrival of the commercially available Valentine's card, however, was heralded by an oh-so-romantic boon in technological printing advances and postal reform. In the Victorian era, printing presses became more widespread, affordable and efficient, and revolutionised the creation of newspapers, books and, most importantly for our prospective procreators, cards. In 1835 alone, around 60,000 Valentine's Day cards were sent via post in Britain, and after the instigation of the penny post some 5 years later, this number shot up to over 400,000. That's a whole lot of love. At Woking Post Office, in 1847, upwards of 500 sweet missives were posted one Friday to be sent to recipients in the area. These cards would depict everything from Halley's Comet to leap years, from lobsters to having genuine dead birds attached, each competing with one another to send the most unique card and expression of love. These cards could also be beautiful constructions, replete with frills, lace, and hidden compartments. Indeed, to say they were pants would have been quite the compliment. They were, on the whole, utterly beautiful, and by the time of mass printing, made tokens of affection available to the masses. And then there was vinegar verse. "A scolding woman's tongue is a scorpion. If you should ever be a wife, oh dear, imagine what a life you'll lead your husband for, I'm sure, your tongue not many would endure." And so begins a romantic tale from man to woman, sort of. The aforementioned verse, far from being a declaration of warmth, was the utter inverse, and epitomises a rise in vinegar verse, also known as mock or satirical valentines, which was scathing and oftentimes insulting epistles characteristic of the mid to late Victorian period. These postcards were designed to chide or insult, and could be sent to jilted lovers or prospective beaux alike. They were cheap, flimsy bits of paper with grotesque caricatures on their front, accompanied by mean-spirited poems. Each card had an archetype it ascribed to. There was the male drunkard, the female snob, and even the ass, as this next example will attest.
Write you down an arse, 'tis done, sir. Oh, what a pretty valentine, and so like you, friend of mine. For everyone says you're an arse, and other donkeys quite surpass.
The vinegar verse really took off in Britain, and estimates are that by the 1870s around 750,000 were being sent each year. It is hard to correctly guess how many were sent, as they were made of cheap degradable materials, and the recipients would have most likely tossed them in the bin or fire after having been insulted. But the insults sometimes went more than skin deep. On the 24th of July 1909, the Hull Daily Mail related a story of a 50-year-old mason in Stoford, near Yeovil, slitting his own throat on receipt of one of these vulgar postcards. Nor was this an isolated incident, as in 1885, as reported by the Pall Mall Gazette, a husband shot his estranged wife in the neck after receiving a vinegar valentine that he knew was from her. A quick flick through Victorian newspapers elucidates a spate of card-caused deaths. Puzzled by Love. Much like the folded fortune teller games played in British playgrounds nowadays, where you pick a number between 1 and 5 and the paper will be manipulated to show your future, the Victorians also employed exquisite origami to achieve bafflement and allure in equal measure. These cards would have on each square a number for the order in which it is to be read, and protestations of love or poems with a final message in the middle. This message would often be accompanied by a ring or lock of hair. More on that later. Once folded, these papers would conceal from the casual observer the gushing from an ardent admirer. Moreover, not only would these paper constructions demonstrate a strong ardour, they would also demonstrate the handicraft and domestic skill of the creator, which were, in their own right, much prized assets. Smelly bushes and horns. Two things you never want to see hammered to your door, but that's exactly what happened in one Surrey village in the 1700s. In Blackheath Village, Woking, couples who were found to have flagrantly flouted village rules, such as extramarital affairs, nagging or being cuckolded, would be tried by their neighbours for perceived social crimes. The offenders, if they failed to repent, would find symbols of their crimes nailed to their door. Horns for cuckolded men and smelly bushes for, unchaste women. These village courts would sit only at certain points in the year. New Year's Eve, Shrove Tuesday, Guy Fawkes Night, and, bizarrely, Valentine's Day. Hairy rings and love locks. To a modern man or woman, having a hairy ring on your finger would be considered incongruous, if a little creepy, but for the Victorian it was seen as haute couture. But why? The giving and keeping of hair was a sign of utmost sentimentality and affection. From babes to mothers, friends to lovers, hair signified a lasting bond, a keepsake, and, often in cases of death, mortuary remembrance and a salve for grief. Aside from the intangible relief it provided, human hair is a lasting material, can retain scent and, importantly for a jeweller, is easily worked into elaborate designs. Whilst the giving of hair was a chiefly feminine affair, the recipients could be of either gender. Men could have it made into watch fobs or braids, and women as rings, necklaces, and even hair bows. Just like the cult of the saints from former days, these very human relics would be cherished, venerated, and prove a sign of utter and undying devotion beyond the mortality of the beloved.
The Pitman of Despair. Joseph Ellis married 20-year-old Isabella Steele in his parish, St. John's Gateshead Fell, when he was 31 years old. As a pitman or collier, who were relatively well paid at that time, he would have expected to be able to provide a comfortable living for his wife and any children they might have. But within a year, disaster struck. An accident befell Ellis. He was crippled by it and would find it impossible to move unaided without crutches for the rest of his life. Even so, Isabella remained with him, maimed though he was, and life carried on. Over the next 12 years, they had 4 children, named after various older family members, and the expanding family continued to live in coal mining communities, with Joseph evidently managing to maintain his title of pitman, even with severely curtailed mobility. The children grew, aged, married, and moved, though not very far in some cases, as one daughter rented the property next door. But Joseph began to struggle. Perhaps due to his infirmity, or the decade difference between him and his younger wife. Whichever it was, the 61-year-old became increasingly jealous of a neighbour that his wife had been speaking to. October of 1856, Isabella was washing the windows of their house in Washington, Durham, when Joseph became irate. His jealousy could no longer be controlled. He struck Isabella, first with a fist and then with a poker. Her cries, loud enough to be heard next door, brought her daughter running. She dragged her mother away to have her wounds tended, and Joseph was arrested. He faced the courts of Durham in December of that year. This crime, whilst violent and vicious, was his first, and as a 61-year-old cripple, the courts recommended mercy. He was sentenced to a lowly 6 years of penal service. He served at Durham Prison for half a year, lightly held in strict seclusion as was the norm, before being moved to Millbank. For Joseph, deemed too weak to endure the mental rigours of silence and separation at Millbank, this was rejected, and he was housed in communication cells instead, the medical officer considering it too taxing for someone of his constitution. During his time in these two prisons, Joseph picked oakum, as his contracted limb did not allow him to work outside, although it's doubtful if the view of the Millbank burial ground near the outdoor works would have added much levity to his sentence. He was transferred to Lewis Prison to lodge with the other infirm inmates whilst awaiting the completion of Woking. Then in March of 1860, he made the journey with dozens of others to the brand new invalid establishment. 2 years later, he was released on licence due to his ill health, with the medical officer of Woking designating him a weak old man. Yet not so weak that he couldn't make it back to Durham and locate his wife. Isabella had taken a job as a housekeeper on a farm where she was comfortably well off, had gained a few pounds, and was contentedly doing for herself. The spectral appearance of her estranged spouse could only be looked upon with disfavour. He stumped into the kitchen of the farmhouse in the morning of 23rd of April, 7 weeks after his release from Woking Prison. Reconciliation with his younger wife was clearly on his mind, and after making some admittedly foolish comment on her weight gain, which thankfully she cheerfully admitted to, he requested a kiss, the forerunner to a resurgence in marital obligation. But Isabella was less than enamoured with the previously violent man with a criminal record. She declined, and told him she was happily looking after herself, as she had been for the last 4.5 years, and pointedly encouraged him to do the same. Joseph was less than impressed. Perhaps it was the damage to his ego, perhaps it was the loss of hope, but Joseph acted, withdrew a knife, and attempted to slit her throat. Thankfully, his decrepit frame allowed Isabella to fend him off, receiving cuts to the face and hands, before her employer threw the convict into the garden. Joseph was arrested and brought before the county assizes. His crime, the second against his poor battered wife, was looked upon with great disdain. In his 60s and crippled, he was 20 years above the average life expectancy for 1862, and this great age, was the only thing that reduced his sentence from 20 years to 10. His first 7 months of imprisonment took place in strict separation at Durham. There was to be no communication between him and any other inmate. This second time through the system, he was not granted an escape from the silence of his own mind. The only distraction again was oakum picking. In 1863, he was returned to Woking, his abode, for the next 7 years. Once again, he was released early. Heaven only knows why, with his penchant for pursuing his poor partner. But in 1870, Ellis died. Valentine in Woking. Valentine's is well known for socially acceptable displays of affection. Sometimes also for the socially unacceptable too, as in the case of Colonel Valentine Baker. Colonel Baker was well regarded in his sphere. He had been medalled in Kaffir Africa and served at both Crimea and the fall of Sebastopol. Then, during peacetime, he served as Assistant General Quartermaster at Aldershot and was a member of the 10th Hussars. His reputation preceded him as a man of integrity and chivalrous honesty. That is until the facade came crashing down. In 1875, Colonel Baker was called to the bar. The court was overwhelmed with attendees, both male and female. People even swarmed through the cells under the building to gain entrance through the dock. The judge had to halt proceedings almost immediately to order the road outside cleared, purely so that he could hear the proceedings. Colonel Valentine was accused of attempted assault, sexual assault, and attempted rape on an unaccompanied 22-year-old woman whilst on a train passing through Woking. The woman, Miss Rebecca Kate Dickinson, was an upper-middle-class unmarried girl of good looks and of a modest and innocent disposition. What was his response to this vile and indecorous crime, you ask? I solemnly declare upon my honour that the lady, under the influence of alarm, exaggerated the case. No protestations of guilt from this military man, oh no, but it was an exaggeration, a confusion on the part of the female. Miss Dickinson was travelling alone for the first time on the 17th of June, no doubt armed with knowledge of the terrible crimes humanity can commit, but not expecting it from so well-placed a man as the middle-aged colonel who joined her in the carriage. Initially, the journey was quiet, a few mild questions, but just after the Woking stop, with the next stop a good half an hour away, Baker started to interrogate the increasingly disturbed damsel. Having tried to talk to her about mesmerism, saying he had a friend who could cause a woman to follow them with no idea at all, he moved on to simpler conversation.
I suppose you don't often travel alone?
Never.
Could you fix a time when you'll be on the line again?
No.
Will you give me your name?
I shan't.
Give me your name that I may know when I hear.
I shan't.
Why not?
Because I don't choose. I don't see any reason why I should. Rebecca was firm in her refusals. Valentine stood and closed the window to the carriage.
Give me your Christian name.
She said nothing, and Valentine crossed the carriage to sit beside her, pulling her hand into his. Get away! I won't have you so near! She pushed him away.
You're cross. Don't be cross.
He put his arm about her waist, and she immediately stood and attempted to pull the cord to summon a guard. It was evidently faulty.
Don't ring! Don't alarm the guard!
He exclaimed and forced her back into the corner. He stood before her, blocking any exit and keeping her against the cushion. He kissed her. He continued to kiss her, holding her in place, and at the nearest moment when she could speak or breathe, she attempted to reason with him. If I tell you my name, will you get off? He said nothing and continued. He then slid his hand onto her ankle, just above the boot. She stood up like a rocket and attempted to break the glass of the window with her elbow. It would not budge. She wrenched down the sash of the door and thrust her head out of the window and screamed. Valentine wrangled her back into the carriage, almost suffocating her in the process. She screamed again, fearing that this may be the last sound she would utter, and heaved open the door to the still-moving train, stepped out onto the tiny footboard, clinging to the door handle and facing possible death. The colonel, evidently terrified that she might die, grabbed her arm and said,
"Get in, dear, get in. You get in and I'll get out of the other door."
Rebecca knew he would not. The door had been locked at Guildford. But they were close to the next station. As soon as they arrived at Esher, people began to rush to their carriage, no doubt having been frightened by the screams and slamming of doors. Baker, now fully aware of his culpability, hurriedly pleaded with the young woman.
Don't say anything. You don't know what trouble you'll get me into. Say you were frightened. I'll give you my name and anything.
Rebecca, exhausted, terrified beyond belief, and still in shock, said nothing. She was helped down from the carriage, Valentine legging it almost as soon as the train drew to a stop and removed to another carriage. Rebecca, still traumatised, stated, "I could not go on alone." And a helpful minister, Reverend Brown, accompanied her to Waterloo, where after giving her name and address to the guards, she left. The next day, the Reverend visited her, no doubt concerned for her welfare, and she shared the full import of the terrifying travel. The Reverend was appalled and took her to the police station to share her tale of woe. So the court heard and acted on it. The defence, in a disturbing show of acceptance, agreed that an event took place. Absolutely, Baker had molested her. But their argument was that he had not intended to ravish her. Ravish in the old sense of the word, meaning non-consensual sex. They did not justify his actions, but made a point that a man such as he, with a long history of serving his country, earning medals and not a stain on his character, surely he would never ravish. The defence went on to state that had he actually wanted to ravish the girl, he would have succeeded. So clearly his lack of success was an evidence of his lack of intent. Baker's counsel closed by offering Rebecca financial restitution and confirmation of her modesty. Had she actually been ravished and admitted it, her reputation would have been in tatters. After 15 minutes, the jury came back, guilty of indecent assault, but not guilty of intent to ravish. The sentence passed was equally laughable. 1 year's imprisonment with no hard labour, as a man of his social sphere would find confinement punishment enough. The public outcry was immediate and voracious. In August, the monarch herself decided that such a man should not be linked to her in any way, and he was removed from the army. It being stated that, "Her Majesty, having no further occasion for his services." The country revelled in this proof that firm good sense and clear perception of duty, which all her subjects gladly believe her to possess. Baker was released, and within 2 years was working for the government overseas, arranging the Turkish police force. For this role, he was paid £2,000 a year, the equivalent of over £100,000 in today's money. In 1884, he died, likely due to complications from a bout of typhus several years before. As for Rebecca, she remained unmarried. Perhaps the Baker incident had terrified her too much. Perhaps it was by choice, as with three upper-middle-class brothers, financially, marriage would not be a requirement for her. Either way, when she finally died in 1915, aged 62, she did so still living in Midhurst, and alone.
Once, twice, 13 times a lady. Marriage is considered a conspicuous declaration of love before friends, family, and state. It symbolises and codifies an everlasting bond between two people for, it is hoped, the rest of their lives. But sometimes some are so enamoured with the idea of love that they can't seem to get enough of it. Gail Gloucester was one such man. Our cheesy antagonist was born on the 22nd of March, 1823, to Charles Gloucester, a furnishing undertaker living at the corner of the Broadway in London, and his wife, the aptly named Honour, a trait which our dear Gloucester sadly did not inherit. Things should have started well in 1849, when Gloucester married the lovely Eliza Cecilia Gee in a ceremony witnessed by both their fathers at Christchurch in London. He was listed as a professional gentleman, an old-fashioned term for someone living off their own means, and in the 1851 census we find the occupation repeated, where he is living with her in Soho. Things, at least ostensibly on the surface, were going well. True, Gloucester would be out for indeterminate periods of time, but the nature of his unspecified work necessitated this, and, in her own words, she certainly never had the most remote suspicion of his marrying anyone else. But that's precisely what he did. Perhaps Gale Gloucester was a proto-Buddhist. The multiple vows our cheesy romantic maid were for all the lives he had hoped to live in future. But either way, he became one of the most prolific, profligate husbands going, and he certainly had the means to do so. A man of property, if not propriety, where all over London he owned houses and wedded women, consummated it, and then after a very short period of conjugal bliss did a runner. In Islington he married Cecilia Mary Y, under the name of George Gordon. In Chelsea, under the guise of George Thomas to Lydia March. In Hanover Square to Sarah Jewett. And in Langham Place to Fanny Farrell. And that's just the start. When the news came out, a decade after marrying his first wife, the media had a field day. Comparisons to Don Juan, Henry VIII and Brigham Young, famed polygamist and founder of Mormonism, abounded in the media, and they were none too kind about his indiscretions. Described in various papers as aged 35 but looks older, an insignificant man, carroty-haired, slight with a somewhat sinister cast, and an ugly Don Juan, the media were out for blood. Nor were their attacks solely focused on the serial bigamist. The North British Daily Mail, a Scots newspaper, attacked the stupidity of English women, with this case in point. It lambasted women for marrying a clearly ugly man, supposing the reason for their amour to be his money, and that his talk about money matters was the sole reason why they were so easily duped. Not merely English serving maids, but their mistresses are continually being cheated by wizards, witches, and fortune tellers. But it is, of course, matrimony which brings out the most gullibility of the fair-haired and blue-eyed daughters of England. It further went on to reprove the English for their stereotypes of the canny Scots, and replied, "It is a reproach which Scots cannot retort, for certainly caution is not an English trait." When the case finally came to court, Gloucester Gale admitted that he was guilty, and asked for mitigation on account of a spinal injury. This was not granted, and he was sentenced to 4 years penal servitude. The court had the last laugh, as when Gloucester asked if he might give some personal effects to his wife, the chairman jokingly asked, "Which one?" But that was not the end of the tale, not by a long mile. Far from the 7 marriages he had been initially charged for, he had in fact married a further 6, promising one that his absences were due to getting a very special monkey for Queen Victoria herself. Another he had got pregnant, and left destitute. Gloucester served his time, but, no stranger to the law, was brought again before the courts under the pseudonym William Gloucester Bryant, where he was declared bankrupt after being sued. It turns out the Beatles were right. Money can't buy you love.
Shot in the face, and God's to blame, you give love a bad name.
You may be wondering what that was about. I do too, if I'm truthful. Note to self, lay off gin. But within that poorly amended song, therein lies the heart of a tale of love and loss. Emery Spriggs, far from being a West Country curse, is the name of our next incumbent inmate. A publican, born and bred in the picturesque village of Westbourne, East Sussex, was a much-liked local man. His wife, Rebecca Spriggs, too, was equally well-liked and respected, despite a few hang-ups and hangovers. Which makes this case all the stranger for the events that transpired one terrible September morning in 1854. Emery had been under a great deal of pressure. The application for an alcohol license for his pub, the Cricketers, was opposed and denied by the Reverend Newland and Church Wardens of Westbourne. His gout also, likely caused by a ready access and excess of alcohol, had begun to flare to such an extent that he started to have delirium, a medically attested state characterized by confusion, hallucination, and aggression. Add to this his wife's severe alcoholism, and we have a cocktail for disaster. The night started well. A ball was thrown at the Cricketers for the members of a benefit society, the ancient order of foresters, and drink flowed freely until a late hour. Emery in particular was very gay and exhibited much hilarity and activity according to the North Devon Journal. His wife also was in good spirits, and later reports state that she fell over a number of times due to intoxication, and had said a few words to him, and had taunted him about having a fancy woman. As the party wound down, and only those two remained, man and wife, a final bloody act took place. No one knows for sure what triggered Emery to kill his wife, whether it was because of, as his defense testified, gout delirium, or due to his wife's antics. But what is certain is that Emery fired his gun at his wife. The bullet went straight through her skull, spattering the wall with gore, and killing her instantly as she fell in the passageway beside the front door of the pub. Emery, far from hiding his crime, roused his neighbour, Mrs. Piles, from the adjoining cottage, and said to her, "Get up, Mrs. Piles, there is a dead woman in the house." She immediately came and saw the grisly spectacle before her, and Spriggs called two further women and asking them to sort out his dear wife and do their duty by her. Their duty in this instance meant removing her from the passageway and tidying up the scene. But before they could complete this task, he collapsed on the body and exclaimed words of such pity that they would save him from the noose. "Oh, Becky, Becky, I've always loved ye and love ye now." As the body was removed upstairs, Emery sought out his friend, Goddard, and told him of the crime. "I had a scuffle with my wife, but I gained the victory. I shot her with a right-hand barrel, and that's the finger," he said, pointing at the forefinger of his right hand, "that did it." Goddard sent for a constable, who sent for a surgeon, and Spriggs was taken into custody at Petworth Jail. The witness descriptions and coroner's reports are harrowing, going into great detail about the extent of the wounds and the state of the crime scene. The only saving grace being that Mrs. Spriggs died instantly, with barely a gasp. During the trial, Goddard spoke about the night in question, fainting in intervals, saying he had known the prisoner and the deceased for 20 years, that formerly they had lived very happily together, but of late the deceased had become addicted to drinking, and this had caused differences between them. The prisoner suffered a great deal from gout. During the evening, Spriggs had requested Goddard to particularly keep an eye on his wife and away from the spirits, but she had done so without his knowledge. The hands of the deceased were very dirty, and her nose appeared to be cut as though she had been falling about. Spriggs only served 17 years for the unlawful murder of his wife. Due to his failing health and repeated petitions for his release from friends and family, he was released in 1867 to return to the village of his birth, where the true punishment was enacted. From the day of his release to the day of his death in 1875, Emery lodged with friends and latterly the workhouse, overlooking the pub and memories of a love and life he cut short and once knew. So there we have it, our lowdown on loved up and banged up Victorian paramours and prisoners. We hope you've enjoyed this podcast. Thank you for listening to the Institutional History Society's Valentine's Special. We couldn't have got this far without the London Archives, the British Library, and the Woking Lightbox. Special thanks to Kevin MacLeod for the use of his music in our podcast. Any comments, requests, or feedback, please send them through to our email, institutionalhistory@gmail.com. To find out more, sign up to our monthly newsletter on our website, institutionalhistory.com.